KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm John Myers, in for Michael Krasny. The cocktail is back. In restaurants and clubs all across San Francisco, Northern California, and elsewhere, the mixed drink of your choice is experiencing a renaissance. And this time with fresh local ingredients blended with classic recipes often forgotten until now. This hour, a light conversation with expert mixologist on the cocktail renaissance. That and your calls coming up on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm John Myers, and for Michael Krasny. The love affair with the cocktail is back. That gets your attention. America's predilection for a celebratory drink or two has taken a lot of forms over the years, and under the category of everything old is new again, we are now in the midst of what some would call a cocktail renaissance. And it's a renaissance of cocktails, as you might say, with a twist, a thirst for local ingredients and personally made mixers. And those in the know say there are two places that really are driving a lot of this: New York City, and of course, right here in San Francisco, as they're leading the way with the cocktail renaissance. This hour, a light discussion, shaken, stirred, blended on the renaissance of the cocktail. Let me tell you who's joining us for the hour. First of all, here in studio, H. Joseph Ehrman, the proprietor of Elixir, a bar in the Mission District and the only certified green bar in San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have you. And then also joining us by phone is Dale DeGroff, who is a master mixologist and the author of The Craft of the Cocktail. Good morning, Dale DeGroff.
Morning, John. Morning, H.
And also with us by phone is Ted Hay, who is the author of The Vintage Spirits and Forgotten Cocktails and the curator of the Museum of the American Cocktail. He is also known as Dr. Cocktail and joins us from New Orleans this morning, or it's afternoon in New Orleans in the Big Easy. Good morning, Ted Hay.
Hi. Hi, all of you.
Happy to have you here, and a fun discussion I think we're going to have for this hour. Let's start first here in San Francisco. H. Joseph Ehrman, who's the proprietor of Elixir. As a bartender, you've been at the center of this resurgence here and this interest in cocktails in San Francisco. What's driving the trend locally?
I think that one of the things at the heart of at least what's going on in San Francisco and the way that we do our drinks here is really a continuation more of our ongoing culinary culture and an extension of the culinary culture to being behind the bar. It's culinary cocktails, bringing the kitchen behind the bar, changing things to utilize all of the fresh produce that we have here, the techniques that we learn from all of our avant-garde and stalwart chefs that live and work in the area. And then on top of that, it's been, I think, really a growth of the beverage industry, how we went through some stages with a beer boom, a craft beer boom in the 90s. We had a wine boom, especially in the Bay Area here. We have so many wine geeks that really know their wine, and they've learned their palates. And now they're extending their palates into finer spirits and a truly American creation, the cocktail, and how those spirits and those flavors blend in the same way that we look at our food.
And whereas some people would think cocktails were kind of a stodgy, you know, older person kind of formality thing, they have become much more than that.
Yeah, and there's a preconception of what the word cocktail and other words affiliated with cocktails mean. There's people that think, you know, they don't know what a highball is, and they think that, you know, there's the martini is a word that for all kinds of drinks. There's one recipe for a martini, and then there's other cocktails, and we call a cocktail glass a martini glass and come up with books of 1,001 martinis. There's all these misconceptions that we're continually working to try to clear up.
So talk about some of the things that you can taste only here in San Francisco. Give me a couple examples of things that, like, you know, even you do at Elixir that are truly local in this cocktail renaissance.
Well, I think there's, like I said, one of our focuses here in the Bay Area, because we have what is it, like 75% or 90% of the country's produce is made in our backyard. You, on almost every bar you can walk into in San Francisco that has a focus on cocktails, you'll see bowls of fruit, fresh produce, herbs, just like if you were looking at into the kitchen and we're cutting the fruit and we're using every part of it in our cocktails, and then we're also using locally distilled products. We've got great focus on craftsmanship with our local distillers like Hangar One and Distillery 209 and Anchor, right? A couple doors down from here, we have Anchor Distilling. All these guys are real close, and it's, again, that continuation of the local supplier in the San Francisco market.
H. Erman, Joseph Erman, is the proprietor of Elixir here in San Francisco in the Mission District. Dale DeGroff, by the way, H. Joseph Erman calls you the godfather of the cocktail renaissance. Dale DeGroff, who wrote The Craft of the Cocktail, a lot of people credit you for starting this trend with fresh ingredients when you were a bartender at the Rainbow Room in New York City. Where did the idea come from?
Well, I'm going to have to send the credit a little further back than me. There was a very important restaurateur who had a significant impact on the way dining has changed in America, and his name was Joseph Baum. And Joe was the guy that opened the Four Seasons restaurant on Park Avenue in that incredible Seagram's building that Le Corbusier and Ludwig Mies van der Rohe and Philip Johnson all worked on, and into which Edgar Bronfen Sr. wanted to put a Cadillac dealership, but Joe talked him out of it, talked him into a world-class restaurant that opened in 1959. And I think you could really go back to 1959 and say that moment when the Four Seasons opened their doors and began serving fresh, seasonal, regional, four times a year changing menus really had a tremendous impact on people like Alice Waters out in San Francisco and Larry Forgione at the American Place in New York and countless young chefs. And also he inspired and mentored Kevin Zraley, who went on to take the stodginess out of wine service and make it a special service again and make it accessible to lots of people by lowering the price and making people feel good about ordering instead of being intimidated by it the way the old service used to be. And Joe mentored me and required of me, when I went to work for him at Aurora and then again at the Rain Room, an old-fashioned bar. He said he wanted a 19th century bar, and I didn't really know what he was talking about, to tell you the truth, but he said, get this book. It's called How to Mix Drinks by Jerry Thomas. And he neglected to tell me it was written in 1862, so after hitting a few libraries, I realized I wasn't going to find it. But I did find it, and I went back to the 19th century and sort of studied what they were up to. And they, of course, were using all fresh because we hadn't gotten around to processing food in the 19th century.
Right.
We have in the 20th. The 20th century has been an absolute disaster for the culinary world. Was an absolute disaster from the very beginning with the First World War through the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl in this country and the Second World War and just a mess. I mean, at every turn, it destroyed American whiskey It really taught commercial food processors how to process their food instead of using fresh. And the grocery store where you can go for aisle after aisle and not find anything that resembles food. But this change that Joe started in 59, going right into what H said, when he, over the last 35 or 40 years, disciples of what Joe started and other people like him have gone on to create a huge audience in America of people that are in love with big flavor, fresh, seasonal, and real ingredients. And I think it was only a matter of time before they walked into a bar, and when that guy pushed the button and the green neon liquid came out for their margarita, they said, no thanks.
Right.
What about those round green things? I think I'd like to have that instead.
You've said that that you feel like it's okay to be a bartender again. How is the profession changing as a result of this? I mean, it was just the excitement factor. How would you describe it?
Well, after Prohibition, pretty much bartending, unless you were in a very high-end hotel situation, but even that's been ruined by the unions, unfortunately, I'm sorry to say, and I'm the union guy, but the unions are not good in bars and restaurants. What happened after Prohibition is people perceived the spirits business as a little off-color because for the whole time it was run by gangsters during Prohibition. So obviously, naturally, coming out of it, there's no family that wants their child to study to become a bartender because it was considered to be really unsavory occupation. It's taken until almost just the last 10 years, I think, for people, young people, to realize that by studying beer and sake and fine spirits and cocktails and really mastering all these different disciplines, you can become an all-around professional in the beverage business.
Dale DeGroff.
That's a good thing.
Yep. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. Let's get our third guest in. Dale DeGroff, of course, again, is the author of The Craft of the Cocktail. Ted Hay, who is in New Orleans and the curator of the Museum of the American Cocktail. Our first two guests, Ted, have talked about forgotten cocktails and reviving them. What's the mission of your museum?
Well, it's got many missions, and it goes from the initial mission, which was we have a bunch of cocktail nerds here, and we all have things collected. Let's show people. It goes from that to the sense that still, despite the revival, as H said, there is still a sense that a martini is a cocktail, and maybe the language is changing that way, but the fact is people don't really get the history of the cocktail. Most people, I mean, I quiz people all the time, how old do you think the cocktail is? And they'll often cite Prohibition as the beginning of the cocktail, whereas in reality, the cocktail's been around since the administration of Thomas Jefferson. And the first citation of the cocktail was in 1803. And, of course, back then, the cocktail was roundly despised, and probably rightly so. But we want at the museum to sort of take people in an honest way through that. If the cocktail was a despicable drink at the beginning, then we want to show them that. We want to show them the progression in both a narrative timeline and a visual timeline through the various eras of the cocktail to those dark moments in the 1970s with the fuzzy navels and so on and so forth to the really grand moments both of the cocktail revival and of the time before Prohibition when bartenders were often required to memorize 150 drinks and be able to make them on the spot.
Let me ask you this, since you're taking the wide view, which you should be doing as the curator of a museum about cocktails, you just hit on it right there. I mean, I'm full disclosure here. I'm a 40-year-old man, and I remember when I was of a certain age, cocktails were what my grandparents drank.
Right.
You know, and so you talked about that era almost, you know, early 70s, late 60s, things like that. What is changing now? I mean, is there a generational change to this? I mean, what do you think it is when you take the long view?
Yeah. I mean, you're exactly right. In a way that makes it too precious. The fact is, it is, I hate to say it, initially it was nostalgia. People would look back at the Thin Man movies, people of in their 20s, and they're thinking, that was sophistication. They'd look at Breakfast at Tiffany and the Audrey Hepburn movies and go, there's sophistication going on there. What's that like? All I know are these sweet drinks and straight vodka and gin. They call it a martini, but what does it even mean? You know, at some point in that period you're talking about, and I'll tell you an irony here. An irony is in the 50s and 60s, what most people consider the pinnacle of the cocktail world, the Rat Pack, Frank Sinatra, that was actually the deconstruction of cocktails. The idea of the martini then being essentially, you know, gin or vodka, wave the vermouth bottle across the room at it, leave out the bitters, which were up until the 50s an intrinsic part of a martini, and you've essentially got a glass of straight spirits, and it's getting bigger, and suddenly it's on the rocks. And at this point, it ceases to be a cocktail at all. And but for people wondering what things were like in the old days with all those bizarre recipes with their strange-sounding names and strange-sounding ingredients, but for them, the cocktail would have died.
Hmm. We're again talking about a renaissance of cocktails. That's Ted Hay, who is the curator of the Museum of the American Cocktail, joining us from New Orleans. Also by phone is Dale DeGroff, who is a master mixologist and the author of The Craft of the Cocktail. And here in studio is H. Joseph Ehrman, who is the proprietor of Elixir, a bar in San Francisco's Mission District. H., let me talk to you about the experience that people come in when they have these cocktails, too. They're not just coming and looking for something, as we said a moment ago, of a green liquid being poured out of something and there's your margarita. You know, there's an experience they want. And as a result, I mean, these take time to produce. And, you know, you don't get your cocktail in 2 minutes. It takes time to put this together as a bartender, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, you know, every bar is different. Every bar has its motif or its role in our drinking society. And my bar, I like to think of it as an exceptional neighborhood bar, but at its core, it's a neighborhood bar. It's the second oldest saloon location in San Francisco. This year, we're celebrating 150 years of nothing but a saloon on my corner. The first one burned down in 1906, along with the rest of the city, and the saloon owner at the time, who had owned that place for 13 years, rebuilt right away, and he rebuilt his saloon and built a whole building around it. So he kept going until, actually, he owned it through Prohibition, sold it in 33. So he owned it for 40 years. And so he was dedicated to serving the neighborhood. And so when I opened, I wanted to be a neighborhood bar. We have TVs and a dartboard and a jukebox, and we have everything that you expect in a neighborhood bar. But on top of that, I've been collecting exceptional spirits and making cocktails and providing education for my customers on every week. So they can come in, they can learn about the core spirits. All my bartenders know what goes behind my cocktails, which I rotate every month. They can talk to them about it. They can walk them through a flight of tequilas and tell them the difference between them. So the experience, from what I try to do, is really educational, and it's also entertaining. The bartenders learn skills. They learn different things about building a cocktail. It's just like a chef would learn techniques about creating a new dish, and you're in it. Essentially a demonstration kitchen where your customers watch you and they ask questions and they're amazed.
And that kind of comes back to what Dale DeGroff was talking about earlier about it's fun to be a bartender, in that way, right?
Yeah, I mean, and you take pride in it.
Now the spectrum in San Francisco, and I'll go back to our other guests in a moment, but your establishment there, and then you've got others that we were talking about before the program began that are really modern-day speakeasies, one in town called the Bourbon and Branch, right?
Yeah.
And how does that work? I mean, I don't want to call it a club, but or a secret. But I mean, how does that kind of thing work?
Well, the speakeasy concept has been growing with the renaissance of the cocktail because of that pre-prohibition era focus on the drinks and that cocktail culture. So that type of culture rolled into the prohibition era and was driven underground, and admittedly, the cocktails most likely degraded because of the lack of good ingredients. So I'm sure that the drinks weren't as good, but the culture didn't just die the day that the government said you can't drink anymore. It was driven underground, and then people developed that, and it became its own little cultural motif that's being reproduced in bars around the country.
And now, you have to ask for a password or something to get in?
That's what Bourbon and Branch does. You need a pass. You can't see when you pass the bar on the street, it's not advertised where it is. And that's all part of the whole shtick there, which is entertaining. And inside, the decor is all of that era. And there are many of these that are popping up around the country.
Well, I want to talk about some of the classic or older or historical cocktails have been revived, but first, Dale DeGroff, let me ask you a question, which is, I read somewhere that you were the guy that kind of brought back the Cosmo at one point at the Rainbow Room in New York City. Is that right?
Well, we were high profile, so because it was on our menu and because Madonna was pictured drinking it at the Grammy party one day, and the picture went around the world, and bartenders were far away as Australia were calling me for the recipe. We had some kind of an impact. I think Sex and the City had a big impact on the drink, too.
Well,
we made a good one. You know, we had fresh.
Well, and I was going to say, I mean, then there was an entire period, and I know this is probably heresy to cocktail renaissance purists, but there was an entire period of the everything with the end teeny. Apple teeny, tartini, So I guess what I'm saying is that you know, the pop culture picked onto part of this, but what you're really, really going at is a much more fundamental classical approach to it, right?
Well, it's more about the ingredients, and I think Doc and H both touched on it. I think the reason the cocktail became, and vodka does have something to do with this, cocktail became less and less appetizing, and by the late 60s, early 70s, was really not much of a player for the younger generations. Still, obviously, you had your older cocktail drinkers, but what happened way back in 1937 when the first artificial sour mix came out called 7-Eleven mix, and by the 1960s, every bar in America pretty much had sour mix, either out of a gun or from a jug or some artificial substitute for real juice. And not only that, the spirits themselves, our liqueurs that were domestically made here in the United States just declined in quality until finally they were just basically sugar water with very low alcohol content. Everything from the ingredient side, and our domestic vermouth was god-awful and still is. So your Manhattans and your martinis made with those were suddenly awful, and I can totally understand why people didn't want any vermouth in their martinis. Number one, because the vermouth was appalling, and number two, because people didn't know how to store it. If they did have good vermouth, they stored it improperly, and it's a wine, it'll go bad.
And it's even going further than that now. I mean, people are making their own tonics. They're making their own bitters, right? I mean,
long as you can do a good job of it, and if there isn't something really good on the market, I think it's a great thing to do.
So we're coming here to the bottom of the hour, and we're going to invite our listeners in a moment to talk about their favorite cocktails, or if they are aficionados of the cocktail renaissance. But Ted Hay, out in New Orleans, tell me about one or two of the classic, quintessential cocktails that are being revived that you would like to revive as well.
Sure, I mean there are a bunch of them, and one of them you've seen revived almost to a fault, the mojito. When I first got into this stuff, no one remembered the mojito, and now it's gotten to the point where, you know, the longer something is in vogue, the quicker they try to figure out a way to make it faster and cheaper, and this becomes the sort of evolutionary cycle of this stuff. There's still good mojitos out there, but this is what's happening. What else is in the offing? I've always loved a drink called a Corpse Reviver Number 2. It's often what I serve people who say, A, I don't like gin, or B, I don't like anise, such as might have been in absinthe. And it is one part gin, one part fresh lemon juice, one part Cointreau, one part Lillet Blanc, which is a French aperitif wine, kind of like Blonde Dubonnet, but maybe a slight orange component to it, and then a couple drops of traditionally absinthe, which suddenly we can get in this country. So that's that's among artisanal bartenders these days, that's a drink that they know.
And that's a drink actually that, thanks to Ted's book, in 1906 or 2006.
I'm not that old there.
No, no, but in 2006, when we had our 100-year anniversary of the quake, I had a big party at Elixir. And I had never known that drink before, and I found it in Ted's book, Vintage Cocktails, and I put it on the menu, and I've been serving it ever since, and it's been one of my favorite cocktails ever since. Impressive. So thanks, Ted.
I'm thrilled to hear it.
it's a little assistance all around here. Well, again, we are talking about a renaissance in cocktails, classic cocktails, and not just that, but also a renaissance that involves local ingredients as well and fresh ingredients. Our guest, who you just heard here in studio, H. Joseph Ehrman, the proprietor of Elixir here in San Francisco, Ted Hay by phone from New Orleans, who's the curator of the Museum of the American Cocktail, and Dale DeGroff, master mixologist and author of The Craft of the Cocktail. And we'd like to get your calls, 866-733-6786. And again, this is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm John Myers in for Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about cocktail renaissance, both here in San Francisco, across the country, different large urban areas with us. And certainly we're fortunate to have some of the foremost folks in the world of really understanding the cocktail with us. Here in studio, H. Joseph Ehrman, the proprietor of Elixir in the Mission District. Dale DeGroff joining us by phone, the author of The Craft of the Cocktail, and Ted Hay in New Orleans, who's the curator of the Museum of the American Cocktail, and affectionately known, I think, as Dr. Cocktail. H, let me ask you a question real quickly, and we're going to bring our listeners in, too. Let me also, before I ask H the question, put that phone number out there again, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. H, when people come in and they want these cocktails, we talked a little bit before that it takes a little bit longer. Maybe you have to give an education to people about that too. Pricing a little more too, because you're using all these in special original ingredients?
Yeah, for sure. I try, again, being a neighborhood bar, not being a downtown bar, I try to make everything accessible. I try to keep my prices low. Generally our cocktails go for about $9. Downtown you may find the same cocktail for $11 or $12, and in LA you may find a worse cocktail for $16 or $18. So it varies from place to place, and especially now, you know, it's I can, you know, just speak as a small business owner, with all prices, all expenses going up, it's getting increasingly hard to keep it at $9. I mean, the effort, you know, your staff is paid by the hour. But
in one way, it's fair to say the old adage, you get what you pay for, sometimes is true.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I could put a bigger premium on those things, but it's you still got to run your business.
Let's get some of our listeners involved. Brian in Davis joins us. Good morning, Brian.
Hello. A few years ago, I was trying to find Pisco in San Francisco, and I uncovered the story of Pisco Punch and how it was the drink San Francisco is known the world around for in the 19th century. The recipe was thought to die with the manager of the bank exchange, where the Transamerica now stands, but it was rediscovered in the 70s by a historian. So I was just curious if you were familiar with it and if you know of any bars around that serve Pisco Punch.
Ted Hay, what do you say about the Pisco Punch?
Well, I can't speak to San Francisco, although I will say that in the 19th century and into the 20th century, San Francisco was interestingly enough known for Pisco drinks and for the Sazerac, a drink that is now almost exclusively known in New Orleans. I know the Pisco Punch story, and I know the secret was the way they treated the pineapple and the sugar involved, but I wish, you know, the fact is, I think the best bet for getting Pisco in San Francisco may well be ordering it. And I believe BevMo has some branches up there. And it's certainly being that it is a chain that's in San Francisco, in California, you ought to be able to get some Pisco from them. And I would recommend the Peruvian Pisco over the Chilean Pisco.
Well, and Brian, that may help you too, being in Davis. As somebody who lives in Sacramento, you could probably find one of those stores. So
I'd like to ask Brian what that recipe is, because I know a lot of us in the business have been trying to recreate that recipe.
Oh, Dale DeGruff, yes.
Well, there's a wonderful article that I had to dig through microfiche from the 70s in the California Historical Quarterly that explains it, but now it's just available on Google. The secret ingredient turned out to be, it called for gum syrup, but the recipe from a former manager sent to a friend included gum arabic, which binds the harsher elements, the protein in the gum arabic binds the harsher elements the same way that the egg white that they use in Peru in making Pisco sours kind of takes away some of that harsh edge.
So they use gum
You take
syrup
that
with
gum
pineapple?
Syrup, you soak pineapple chunks in it, and then you mix the pineapple-flavored syrup with some lemon and Pisco and distilled water.
You're educating the experts here, Brian.
Brian, have you tasted gum syrup? Because gum syrup did originally mean it had gum arabic in it as opposed to just simple syrup. Have you had some?
Oh, absolutely. Well, this article from the 70s talks about how to make it yourself, and that was the real key to cracking the recipe, was you have to order the gum arabic yourself.
It's pretty expensive.
Yeah. Brian, let me thank you. H, what were you going to say?
Well, we just recently completed in May. We had I'm a co-founder of San Francisco Cocktail Week, and that happens right around World Cocktail Day in the middle of May every year. And as part of it this year, we had my friend Diego from Bar Sol Pisco came out, and we did a pilgrimage. He found the grave of Duncan Nickel, who was the saloon keeper of the bank exchange, and we took a pilgrimage out there in a bus.
And that's hardcore.
It was pretty cool. And then we had a panel discussion afterwards about Pisco Punch as the San Francisco cocktail and its history there. And we served Pisco Punches. And there's a woman who bartends at Salina D'Or, Jennifer, who is actually making pineapple gum now that I'm buying. I just did a menu for the Level 3 restaurant at the JW Marriott, and I put a Pisco Punch on that menu, and I called it the Bank Exchange Punch and gave it a little twist with some St. Elizabeth's Allspice Dram, and I'm buying pineapple gum from her, as are some other bars and restaurants.
Nice.
Something tells me the listeners in this half hour are going to need a piece of paper and a pen because I think this is going to be the way it goes. Let me go. First of all, I'll thank Brian and Davis for that call. Let me go to Teresa in Oakland. Teresa, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Well, firstly, I'm a big fan of the Rainbow Room's French 75, which has a little bit of Luxardo in the mixture, and it's excellent. But we always have this controversy amongst my friends whether the gin mixture of French 75 or the cognac brandy mixture is the one. And the second question that I have is, how do you make a Bronx that tastes decently? Because my husband and I have tried to make Bronxes before, and it was not tasty at all.
Dale DeGroff, I'm gonna pitch this one to you.
Sure. The French 75 was originally a gin drink, and the cognac version developed later on. I personally prefer the gin drink. I think it's more refreshing, and I think originally the idea was kind of a Tom Collins, where you dump the club soda and replace it with champagne, which is a marvelous idea. So I think, and it's a drink like the Bloody Mary that's open for a lot of interpretation. Some people do it in big goblets with lots of fresh fruit inside, which I think is marvelous. Some people do it in a flute, very simply, with just a lemon peel or something like that. So there's a lot of room for creativity in that drink. The Bronx, I think, the way we did it at the Rain Room to make it quite popular, and I had it on my menu for many, many years, was just to increase the amount of juice a little bit. And I know these days for sort of the cocktail geeky crowd who want really, really strong drinks, there's an aversion to that. But for the average guest that came to the Rain Room, we did equal parts of sweet and dry vermouth, and I put a dash of bitters into, and then we did, fresh squeezed orange juice, and that really did make the drink, in my opinion.
Hmm. Teresa, let me thank you for the call. I've got so many folks who want to talk about cocktails here so early in the morning. Of course, our next caller, Joel from Avon, Connecticut. It's not so early in the morning. Good morning, Joel, or good afternoon.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. All right, actually, you're right. Good afternoon. I just wanted to have a comment. I recently went to the opening of the MGM Grand Hotel at the Mohegan Sun, and I went into the bar and ordered a martini, which to me is a gin and vermouth martini, and the bartender brought me back a martini with vodka in it, and when I suggested that be gin, she brought it back again, and I said, there doesn't seem to be any vermouth in it, and she says, we don't carry vermouth. Nobody's ever asked for it. It was just disturbing. I've discovered that back here in the Northeast, unless I'm in a bar like at the Waldorf or at the Algonquin, when you order a martini, you have to specify what you like in it.
Hmm. Joel, thank you. Let me Dale DeGroff and H. Joseph Herman. I want to ask both of you something about this. But the question goes something along lines of this: how do you find the places that really know what they're doing? I mean, what is the average consumer to do sometimes when they don't, they walk into a place like that? Dale DeGroff maybe first, and then I'll go back here in studio.
Yeah, and remarkably, I'm happy to say that in cities, even medium-sized cities all over the country, there are places that are doing really extraordinary cocktails. And I think you can find them online just by Googling. Drinks, cocktails, New York City, cocktails, San Francisco, I think you're going to get articles popping up that will direct you to the right. And of course, just the regular city guides from the towns that you're in.
Let me bring in H if I can. If you're here in the Bay Area or here in San Francisco, what do you do? Of course, we go to Elixir.
That's your
promo.
Just come to the bar and ask me. like Dale said, I have Google Alerts. I'm not trying to plug Google, but I use Google Alerts for certain keywords that tell me when things are coming up, and you can do that. The local media has really kind of embraced our culture here and has done quite a good job. I'd say the local kind of glossy magazines, the Chronicle, our friend Gary Regan, which a friend of all of ours, writes a weekly column called The Cocktailian. The Chronicle has been great about supporting our cocktail culture here. If you just read those things in the wine section and pay attention from week to week, you'll get to know who's doing what because the media's talking about it. Hmm.
I'd like to say too,
Ted Hay, yes.
Yeah, that now, like for cigar smokers, we have Cigar Aficionado. There's actually a nationally published consumer magazine for people who drink anything, be it tea or sparkling waters or wine or beer or cocktails, and they discuss bars and the bartenders, some would call them bar chefs, mixologists, cocktailians around the country that are doing really interesting things. And that magazine is called Imbibe.
Yeah. John, something else occurred to me.
Sure, Dale DeGroff.
The Zagat survey has just begun surveying bars, and they're going to begin by, for the most part, surveying bars that are in restaurants that have been surveyed, but Zagat has surveyed a lot of places. And they've partnered with a website called idrinkwell.com where you're going to be able to go to find cool bars in cities all around the country.
Hmm, interesting. Okay, I've got lots of folks who want to know about specific drinks and specific products, so let's see what we do here. Jen in Berkeley, let me have you ask your question here first. Hi.
Hi there, guys. I heard somebody talking earlier about the dreck that is commercial sweet and sour, and I'm very fond of squeezing my own juices and infusing my own syrups, and often I run into problems with things like maraschino cherries. Like, where do you get good maraschino cherries? I've found Amarena cherries from Italy, which are lovely. But I'm interested in finding a more authentic, perhaps, maraschino cherry, or maybe being able to make my own.
Let's ask our local man, H. Ehrman, here. Thanks, Jen.
We're really kind of at the getting towards the tail end of our Bing cherry season right now, and I'm a freak about Bing cherries. I buy cases of them. I pit them. I freeze them. I'll make my own maraschino cherries all the time. I've got a bunch of cherries behind my bar right now because there's so many. I've got agave cherries. You can look up recipes online. Just get yourself a bottle of maraschino liqueur and a big mason jar and full of cherries and fill it up. You can put cinnamon in there. You can put all kinds of ingredients in there. This is the time to do it right now.
It's a good idea.
And because the cherries will be gone soon. Other than that, there are some. Go to your cocktails, like your BevMo, and anywhere else that has specialty products, gourmet spots, and you'll be able to find some. I think Luxardo makes a bottled one that's good.
Dale DeGroff, I'm going to throw this question to you, emailed in from Dan in Oakland. He wants to know, any recipes for a drink low in sugar without using juice or syrupy alcohol, because some people are sensitive to sugar. Any suggestions?
There's a couple of suggestions. If you replace sugar with agave syrup, which you can make by mixing agave nectar with water, and agave nectar is very widely available now in Whole Foods and all kinds of grocery stores, gourmet grocery stores. Agave nectar is a very complex carbohydrate that breaks down very slowly in your body, and even diabetics are sometimes recommended, pointed at rather than sugar, at agave nectar. That's one possibility. If you really want to entirely cut out carbohydrates, you can go the route of using Splenda and daiquiris and things like that, which I've done quite successfully, actually. It works fine. They have their liquid form now, and you can make daiquiris with that just as easily as you can with sugar and cut out the carbs.
And let me, Ted Hay, I've got a question I want to ask you. A listener in the Bay Area town of Crockett, Marion Crockett, asks, please address the martini, which is, and she puts in all caps, only made with gin. All these other drinks being served under that name are cocktails. It annoys me to no end when asked if I want my martini with vodka or gin. At the risk of opening
up the martini,
big can of worms, you know, are they both right? Is she only right?
Well, no. I mean, the fact is, I used to take that exact form of umbrage, but I've grown as I learned more about the history. And the history is, much of what we call a cocktail and accept as being a cocktail were once other beverages. I mean, ever since Prohibition, since after Prohibition, you could serve somebody a highball and call it a cocktail, a single-serving punch and call it a cocktail, a sling and call it a cocktail, fizz, call it a cocktail, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So to some extent, the human language changes, and the most popular of those beverages, the cocktail, sort of ended up cannibalizing the other categories. Yes, we still know what the other things are, but we call it a cocktail. The most perfect example of this is you invite somebody over to your house. Hey, want to come over for a cocktail? Sure. Hand them a beer. They don't bat an eye. You know, it's become iconic, you know, more than any specific thing. And as far as the martini thing is concerned, I think to some extent that's happening there too. But what's going to keep that from happening is the increasing education from the cocktail resurgence. I was just writing a caption for the apple martini the other day because we wanted to display, I mean, you know, it went a long time between the margarita and the cosmopolitan, and then the apple martini. There weren't a lot of utterly immortal cocktails in that time, and as much as I might hate to say that the apple martini may be the one for the future, it sort of is trending that way. And what I see is, because it's a relatively new drink, the bartenders are scratching their heads. How do we make this dog better? Because it was initially just pucker and vodka, and it's hard to get much worse than that, but you see them adding fresh apple juice, you see them infusing their own vodkas with apples, you see them using imported liqueurs instead of the pucker and adding some lemon juice to increase the tartness. So we're actually beginning to see an evolution of the nature of a given cocktail before our eyes, and all of them went through it.
All right, Ted Hay in New Orleans. Let me get Krista in San Francisco on. Krista, good morning.
Hi there. Thank you for this. I grew tired a couple months ago of drinking beer and wine, and I started making my own whiskey sours. And it seems to take a lot of the lemons and limes to make one. And my son pointed out there's these little lemons and limes that are sold in the fruit department, fruit of the grocery store. Can you use those instead?
So we're talking. Dale DeGroff?
Yeah, the thing to look for when you're juicing fruits are the thinner skinned. Stay away from the fancy fruits, what would be described as fancy by a grocer, because the fancy fruits have thick skins and very little juice. The ones that are cheaper are actually much better for juicing, and I absolutely would encourage you to go to the grocery store and find those small, yellow, thin-skinned lemons and use those. They're going to have a lot more juice than the big, fancy, thick-skinned lemons, absolutely.
All right, Krista, thanks for that call. Dale DeGroff, while you're on the line here for a moment, a listener named Rebecca in San Francisco, I'm just going to pass this on to you because this is... It just goes to show your influence in the world. I have Dale DeGroff to thank for my love and appreciation of cocktails. I'm going to try to paraphrase her longer email here, but she says, early in her culinary career in the mid-90s, she was a culinary intern at the Rainbow Room when you were working there. And one day after work, one of her fellow cooks and herself, they cleaned up and they sat at the bar, and she didn't know what she wanted to have, and she was only 22. And the bottle of Campari looked intriguing, and she said, how about something with Campari? And you made her a Negroni? Am I saying it correct? And,
yeah,
and to this
are.
Day, it's one of her favorite drinks.
It's a great drink. Actually, the master of the Negroni is a man who lives in Florence now named Luca Picchi. He wrote a book called Count Negroni, and if you get a chance to get your hands on it, sadly it's only in Italian, but it's going to be coming out in English. But it's a fabulous, classic, wonderful, and it's I'm happy to say coming back.
and left a mark with this listener. Again, if you want to participate in this conversation about classic cocktails and the cocktail renaissance, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Tom is in San Francisco. Good morning, Tom.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Fabulous panel. Question or just a comment, if you could care to comment on the proliferation of really good spirits that are available now as opposed to 10, 15, 20 years ago, and really where that started and what's been driving it, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks Tom. H. Ehrman.
Like I said earlier, there's a lot of great spirits, in the Bay Area. We've got some of the ones I've mentioned, as well as some that are headquartered here because of the location, again, and the culinary stuff, like Square One Organic Vodka, a company that I work with that makes great vodka. There's great stuff going on in Portland. There's up in Oregon. They've got a craft distillers. I don't know if it's a union or whatever, but there's small distillers popping up everywhere. I think people are tired of the mass-produced products. We've also seen some of the bigger names in the spirits world. Once they, as with a lot of products and consumer products, they get to a certain popularity level, production level. There's consolidation. The brand gets bought by a bigger brand, and then that brand loses its focus on its craft side, and they start mass-producing it. And then next thing you know, you find that they've changed distilleries, and the product has gone downhill. It's not what it used to be when it launched, but now the whole branding concept has taken over, and everybody knows that one brand, and that becomes their knee-jerk brand, and the product really isn't that good. So I work a lot with smaller brands in trying, and I actually don't carry certain big brands simply because, not because I have anything against them, but because I've invested in a collection of craft spirits from around the world that I want my customers to appreciate. I want them to try them. And if I allow them to fall victim to the knee-jerk reaction of a big brand, then I'm denying them the access to the discovery of a new craft spirit that I have invested in and that I feel is excellent.
And a couple of other things that have come up in this hour about particular drinks. Kelly, one of our listeners, emailed in to talk about, we were talking about Pisco Punch and Pisco Sour. Kelly says Nopa is featuring Peruvian Pisco as a spirit right now, Nopa here in San Francisco.
Yeah, there's a lot of us have Pisco now.
And okay.
Pisco's pretty widely available in San Francisco. A lot of bars have grasped the punch and the sour.
Kelly also happens to be one of our interns. My producer just told me so. So she had an inside category there. A couple of other. One other. And Paul from Oakland. This one I just read and I'll just throw out there. Paul from Oakland says gum arabic, which we were talking about before. Gum arabic is available by the gallon from Offset Printing Supply Companies.
Wow.
So there's an unusual place to find an ingredient for a drink.
I think with the gum arabic, though, a lot of my I don't do a lot of making my own stuff, but a lot of my friends do. And what I've found is that the gum arabic is actually hard to work with.
You know something?
Dale DeGroff, yes.
In those days when they used gum arabic, processed sugar was a lot rougher of a raw material to work with. And in many cases, what they were doing is trying to give it a little smoothness and a little give it a nicer texture. I think our sugar today, if you want to make good simple syrup, you don't really need to have the gum arabic to create that silky texture. You can get it from just a sugar and water.
Let me go to a caller, Jose from San Jose. Good morning. Are you there, Jose?
Yeah, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
My question is actually it's more of a cocktail shooter, cocktail shot. I was wondering if any of you guys know the origins of the liquid cocaine and or the true way to make it, because I've had it done differently in different bars, and I was wondering if any of you guys knew the origin.
Ted Hay, do you have any thoughts on that? Thanks, Jose.
I'm afraid not.
Okay.
When it comes, that's a little bit too recent for my knowledge.
H, you want to take a shot at it? He's thinking maybe.
Well, yeah. I mean, I have customers that come and ask for it, and I don't know much about the history of it. It seems to me to be more of kind of a club type shot. It's very high alcohol. The whole liquid cocaine name. I think it's, if I'm not mistaken, it's Rumpelmintz, Jägermeister, and Goldschlager or something like that, which are all very high alcohol, sweet liqueurs that we don't sell a lot of, quite frankly.
Right. Let's go to Lamar in Oakland. Lamar, good morning.
Hi. I don't drink anymore, but I have wonderful memories of Ramos Gin Fizzes, and nobody I know has ever had one. Whatever happened to that drink?
Ted Hay?
Yes. Well, you can walk into almost any classic bar in New Orleans and get one. I mean, they are still made.
And what is it again, Ted?
I'm sorry?
And what is it again? Describe it for the people.
It's got gin in it, and it's got milk in it, and it's got orange flower water in it. And the recipe changes. It's over 100 years old, so the recipe changes depending on who you talk to. But it also has egg white in it, and that is the main reason you don't see too many bars make it. There's the worry that you might get botulism. There's the sense that the bartender thinks it's too much of a hassle, and the dishwasher hates it.
Well, and I was glad you brought that up, because another listener emailed in and said that she collects old cocktail books, and it seems a lot of vintage drink recipes contain eggs, and wondering if there was a health issue in places about that, and why you're not seeing many of those. And,
yeah, well, yeah. I mean, the fact is in strict answer to her, yes. I mean, you can get pasteurized eggs. You can get pasteurized egg whites, pasteurized whole eggs. If there's any worry, I think with modern refrigeration technology throughout the chain from the chicken to the grocery store, there are really virtually no problems anymore. Plus, I'm a fan of putting the egg in first, then adding the spirit. I think that's going to kill just about anything.
Let me get David in Oakland on quickly. David, good morning.
I was just wondering if any of your people are familiar with the St. George Spirits Distillery in the East Bay in Alameda. They make things that border on the alchemical as far as making drinks and whatnot is concerned. Eau de vies, liqueurs, absinthe, scotches. Probably they've heard of them. I would hope so. And I'll just take my answer off the air.
Thanks, David. H?
Yeah, St. George is about also what I mentioned earlier. They make Hanger One vodka. They make a great new absinthe called St. George. And Lance Winters, the master distiller, there's a friend and a genius, quite frankly. He's done amazing things.
And you can't underestimate this return of absinthe, can you? I mean, because that was something that was verboten for decades and decades.
Yeah, and it's becoming, it had a big bang out of the gate, and something we did a lot of absinthe sales, and we continue to do it. There's some great brands, the first ones out there, Kubler and Lucid and St. George being local, and now there's Lafay and some others coming out. They're going to continue to roll out. It's basically the spirit was away for almost 100 years, and now it's back, and it's lending into things like cocktails as well, because it becomes a cocktail modifier.
So I would be really remiss as we wrapped up this hour if I didn't ask three experts on cocktails to tell me what their current cocktail they really are focused on, because everybody's got one. Let me start with Dale DeGroff, if I could. What are you drinking these days or pouring these days, Dale?
I've been playing a lot with a sort of a modern version of a very old drink called the Whiskey Smash, where I mash up lemons, and I usually use something different than sugar. I'll use like orange curacao or something as the sweetener, and then add the whiskey, maybe some mint, and in the summertime you can throw some peaches in there too, and it makes a really good whiskey punchy kind of drink. And then I shake them all up together after I mash them and strain them over ice, and maybe put a slice of peach and a slice of lemon. It's just a nice summer thing.
Ted Hay, what about you quickly?
Okay, yes, but mine, and they're not going to believe me, and I'm going to say try it anyway.
Say it quickly.
It is a combination of scotch, ginger beer, and lime juice, and it's superb, especially if you don't like scotch.
Wow, and unfortunately, H. Irvin, we're going to get yours at Elixir, because we've come at it, so our local audience can come to Elixir and get yours. H. Irvin, the proprietor of Elixir here in San Francisco, Ted Hay in New Orleans at the Museum of the American Cocktail, Dale DeGroff, master mixologist. It's been an interesting hour. Thanks to all of you. I'm John Myers in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.